Okay, I think we're ready to get going. Tonight we're going to move on and look at the next stage of Muslim empires. So you've got a handout entitled Turkish Empires. Slides are entitled The Crusades, which seem two completely different topics. I didn't harmonize those. But let's pray.
God and Father, we again turn our attention to the events of history and look back in time and consider your people in the Middle East with the vagaries of history that befell them as they sought to live out their lives within a succession of different empires and sought to live out their lives under you, no matter what political rulers and worldly powers they had over them. We thank you that you have preserved your church in the Middle East through all these turmoils of history and that you had your people there. I pray you give us understanding of what we look at tonight. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Okay, last week we looked at how the various Muslim empires got going, that with the death of Muhammad in 632, he was succeeded by this series of caliphs, the Arabic word caliph meaning successor, and we had the Rashidun Caliphate of these four successors ending up with Ali, and that the death of Ali led to this divide between the Shia and the Sunni, that the Sunni recognized those four caliphs and the Shia recognized only the fourth one, Ali, and then the Shia were... It was a major downfall for them when Ali's son Hussein was killed at the Battle of Karbala, commemorated in the festival of Ashura, which was about 2 weeks ago. And then ever since then, there's been this fundamental divide between the Shia and the Sunni within the Arabic world, the Muslim world. Sunni account for 85 to 90%, Shia account for 10 to 15%. The Rashidun Caliphate was succeeded by the Umayyad Caliphate, ruling out of, they moved their capital to Damascus, and then that was succeeded by the Abbasid Caliphate, which established Baghdad, which would emerge as a great center of culture and learning. For a little while, a rival caliphate got going in Egypt, the Fatimids, but all of these were essentially Arab groups. But then in the 10th, 11th centuries, a new group of people appeared on the scene, and these are the Turks. So that's why I entitled this whole section here, The Turkish Empires. The Turks are not originally from Turkey. They're from 1,000 or 2,000 miles away from there in Central Asia, the steppes of Central Asia, what we now would call the Turkic republics, that are these now independent countries that were part of the Soviet Union, so Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, all those stans that are there, all of which speak various Turkic languages and are still inhabited by the Turkic people. One of those peoples back 1,000 years ago, the Seljuk Turks had converted to Islam, and they migrated south into Persia. So they were originally from up here to the east of the Aral Sea and moved down into Persia. And there they adopted Persian language and culture. And then they expanded westwards from there over towards Anatolia, what is today Turkey. And in 1071, here at the Battle of Manzikert, this was a major battle. They defeated the Byzantine army. So the Byzantine Christians with their capital in Constantinople. So this was a major blow for the Byzantine Empire. They'd already lost a lot of their territory down here to the Arab Muslims. And now they were losing territory to the Turkish Muslims. And then in the next few years, they lost pretty much all of the territory of Anatolia. Suleiman, who was a Seljuk commander at the Battle of Manzikert was sort of in charge of this area up here, northwest Anatolia. He captured a number of the major cities. And then in 1077, he set up an independent little sultanate. And that was the beginnings of the Seljuk rule within Turkey. Now, what he called that is it was called the Sultanate of Rome, of Rum, and would last from 1077 to 1307. So why Rum? Well, Rum is the word for Roman. So it was called the Sultanate of Rum because until he took control of that, this was all part of the Roman Empire. Now, admittedly, the Eastern Roman Empire, and the Byzantines viewed themselves as Greek. Well, they viewed themselves as both Greeks and Romans. This is where it gets a little confusing as to what we call them. But it was the Roman Empire, and so when the Seljuk Turks took over, they called it the Sultanate of Rum. Later on from this will come, this region will come Rumi, the Sufi mystic, which simply means the Roman. Well, he wasn't really Roman, but he was in the Sultanate of Rum. Its capital was at ancient Nicaea, up here, where the first ecumenical council had been held. And then later on, he moved his capital to Konya, down there, which is where Rumi was from, the Sufi mystic. And this sultanate would last until the early 14th century, started decaying late 13th century. Meanwhile, other Seljuk forces had come down and captured Jerusalem from the Fatimid Egyptians. So the Fatimids had this dynasty down here in Egypt, captured Jerusalem from them, and then in 1091 expelled all the Christian priests, and then in 1098 the Fatimids retook the city. Now, all of that forms the backdrop to what is going to happen next, which is the Crusades. So that's what we'll move on and spend a good bit of time looking at. The Crusades are a controversial topic, to say the least, when you're talking about the history of the Middle East. Were they a good thing? Were they a bad thing? Should the West apologize for the Crusades? Who should they apologize to? Were the Crusades justified? Over the next 200 years, there were between 7 and 9 Crusades, depending upon how you count them. What were the origins of the Crusade? There isn't agreement even on that. What initially sparked them off was that in 1095, the Byzantine emperor, Alexios Komnenos, sent a message, or he sent envoys to the Pope to ask for assistance in resisting the Seljuk Turks who had taken pretty much all of Anatolia. And after the Battle of Manzikert and after the subsequent victories in the next few years, all that the Byzantines had left to them was, well, the capital there, a little bit of Thrace up here, this little bit of territory here and here, Trebizond and Sinope. This here was ruled by the Armenians, Cilicia, and that's really about all that the Byzantines had left. So they sent these envoys to the Pope, asking for intervention. Now, it took quite a bit for the Patriarch in Constantinople to be willing to request help from the Catholics. Remember that 1054 was the Great Schism, the mutual excommunication between the Byzantines and the Roman Catholics. So to have just 45 years later, the Byzantines willing to request Catholic assistance took a fair bit of eating humble pie. Perhaps viewed this as a chance to try and heal that schism. Unfortunately, that's not what would happen. But in 1095, the envoys came to the Pope, and Pope Urban II was amenable to this. He convened a council, the Council of Clermont in France, and he issued an appeal to all Christians to go and fight and help out the Byzantine church recover their lands from the Seljuk Turks. And the people responded, they got all excited about this, and they responded, Dieu le veut, or Deus vult, God wills it. So this gave this a great divine justification. And in 1096, off they went. There were three waves of crusaders, and they all passed through Constantinople on their way then to the Holy Land. The first wave was a rabble. They were ill-equipped and poorly disciplined. They called the People's Army or the Peasant's Army, led by Peter the Hermit. So some of you might have done a bit of reading of Crusader history. They were a bit of a disaster. They were followed up by two subsequent waves of better equipped, proper troops, better equipped for fighting, who did succeed in getting military objectives down in the Holy Land. Now, the problem was, before these three waves even left Europe, they massacred a whole load of Jews in the Rhineland. Sort of the attitude was, well, why are we going to the Holy Land to kill a load of Muslims when we've got all these Jewish unbelievers here? Let's start by killing them. So there's terrific massacres before ever they got to the Holy Land. Then when they got to the Holy Land, and this was true in Anatolia as well, they found all these people that looked Muslim. And so they just massacred them, and then later on found that they were actually Christian. They just, they looked Arab. Well, they were Arab. It's just they were Christian, not Muslim. Many of them were also Jews. They succeeded in capturing Jerusalem after a five-week siege. Terrific slaughter. And then they expelled all of the non-Christians from the city. Now, what they should have done at that point, what the Byzantines wanted them to do, was to return Jerusalem to Byzantine control. After all, it had originally been part of the Byzantine Empire until the Muslims had captured it in the 7th century. But that's not what they did. Instead, they carved out a series of kingdoms. And they set up four crusader states. So the Kingdom of Jerusalem, and in 1099, Godfrey of Bouillon declared himself the leader, the head of that state, and took the title the Protector of the Holy Sepulchre, and then took the title of the Patriarch. Now, there was a patriarch there, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, who was part of the Eastern Orthodox Church, part of the Byzantine Church. He had to flee up to Cyprus and sort of went into forced exile. Godfrey of Bouillon died the next year, 1100, and his brother crowned himself the King of Jerusalem, Baldwin I. And for the next 200 or so years, this kingdom of Jerusalem will wax and wane in power. Further up the coast was the little state of Tripoli, then the state of Antioch, and the state of Edessa. So Jerusalem, Tripoli, Antioch, and Edessa, these four little, what we call the crusader states. And this has led to questions about, well, what were the crusaders all about? Did they really want to deliver the holy sites from Muslim rule in order to restore Christian sovereignty over them, in which case they should have returned them to the Byzantines? Or was it that they wanted to go and carve out their own little empires, and that there was a surplus of people in Europe who were hungry to rule their own little countries? And then this call to go and be knights for the Crusaders, was that because there was a problem of too many young men from aristocratic families who had nothing to do? What better to do than go off and put on the sign of the cross and go and wage some battles? So were the Crusades a convenient way of answering some of the issues that were going on in Western Europe, or were they motivated really by what was going on in the Middle East? Had the Muslims done enough to warrant the Crusaders coming in? So this is a matter of considerable controversy within academic circles. partly depending upon how politically correct you choose to be. The politically correct option is to say, well, the Crusades were a terrible mistake, this was a great travesty, and the Muslims hadn't done enough to deserve this. On the other hand, the Seljuk Turks had captured most of the Byzantine Empire, and it's not at all perfectly conceivable why the Byzantine Emperor Alexios Komnenos appealed to the West to come and help it. I mean, it was viewing that it was near extinction in the eastern end of the Mediterranean. So that debate rumbles on. One of you was asking last week, Johan was asking last week about Rodney Stark. Had he written about the Muslims? Well, he wrote one of his many books is about the Crusades, and he takes much more conventional, sort of pro-Christian, pro-Western view that the Crusades were a perfectly natural thing to happen, and we don't need to apologize for them. Yes, Martin.
One question. I mean, if the Constantinople, that's where they called for help, basically, the church, why didn't they go there and try to re-expand the kingdom around Constantinople? If they're really there to help, you'd think that's where they would have started.
That's what the Byzantines would have liked. Right. Absolutely, yes. That's what they were appealing for help for. And the Byzantines, they hadn't had Jerusalem since 637. So the 450 years since they'd had Jerusalem, I don't think they had any particular expectation of getting that back anytime soon. They wanted Anatolia back. But that's where, once this got this divine justification put on it of God wills this, Dieu le veut, and then acquired this vision of going and capturing the sacred sites from the Muslim infidels, that then has much greater appeal to these Western crusaders, second and third sons of noble families who don't have really anything to do. And this is a vision that captures them to go and reclaim the holy sites. But yes, it's not what the Byzantines were asking for. In 1104, they captured Acre here, or Akko, and called it Saint-Jean d'Acre, which eventually became abbreviated to Acre, and that would then become an important crusader town or city. And even today, there are extensive crusader buildings there, as well as in Jerusalem, extensive crusader buildings. So the crusaders rebuilt the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which had been destroyed in the mid 11th century by the Egyptian ruler. And the king of Jerusalem established his palace at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Well, rebuilt that as a crusader building, established his palace there until a little bit later moving it to the citadel, which is on the location of Herod's palace and Pilate's palace from on the west side of the old city of Jerusalem. The Dome of the Rock was turned into a church, and it was all made into a crusader city. And if you go to Jerusalem today, there are extensive crusader remains to see, including things that are passed off as being the venue of the Last Supper, the Canaculum, which tour guides will claim is where Jesus celebrated the Last Supper, but is a crusader building. King David's tomb on Mount Zion, where David is supposed to be buried, and that too is a crusader building, but still 1,000 years old. The crusaders then established the Order of the Knights Templar, and this was founded to protect pilgrims to Jerusalem. And it was based in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Templars wear a white cloak with red cross. You'll all be familiar with seeing images of crusaders wearing that garment. And they would then survive here in the Holy Land for 200 years, and then will eventually have to retreat to Rhodes after the crusaders lose their last toehold here in the Levant. Then will become an important part of Rhodes. And so those of you who have been to Rhodes, any of you been to Rhodes? Rhodes also is a beautiful, well-preserved medieval city that at its heart is a crusader with a beautiful crusader building palace at its center, rebuilt by Mussolini. Okay, that's the first crusade. So Western Europe, Catholic powers established themselves in the heart of Muslim territory, retook the Holy Land. Was this religious? Was it political? Certainly carving out these states gave them their own little countries to rule. Then in 1144, Edessa, which was up here, was captured. And that led to a call for a second crusade. And unfortunately, this is then what's going to happen in the next 200 years. Each time one of these bits of these states is captured, there is call for another crusade to go and try and retake that territory. So Pope Eugene preached a second crusade. Fortunately, Bernard of Clairvaux was co-opted, somewhat voluntarily, to go and preach this crusade. He did that. He traveled throughout France and the Rhineland, calling for this crusade. Unfortunately, yet again, many Jews got killed in the Rhineland as the crusaders were gathering and getting ready to go. Again, the attitude was, well, why go off to the Holy Land to kill infidels if we've got all these infidels here? Let's kill them first. Bernard of Clairvaux and the Pope were horrified at that, and they tried to intervene and put a stop to that. But it's difficult when you unleash the passion of the rabble. It's difficult to put that back in the bottle. They went back there ostensibly to try and capture Edessa, and in that they were not able to succeed, and this crusade was pretty much a failure. Now, I put down there that a little bit after this, Baldwin IV is the king of Jerusalem. He's the king that has leprosy, and that might evoke in your mind the Kingdom of Heaven, right, where Edward Norton plays King Baldwin with leprosy, with his face covered. And it's the aftermath of the Second Crusade and then leading up to the Third Crusade that forms the storyline for the Kingdom of Heaven, the movie. Saladin, who is portrayed extensively in that movie, was a Kurd, so he's of the Kurdish people. He was born in Tikrit, now famous as the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, his hometown. And Saladin had become the ruler of Egypt. He was the Sultan of Egypt, but he had set up his own new dynasty, the Ayyubid dynasty. He was the son of a man called Ayyub, which is the Arab word for Job. So he was Ibn Ayyubi. Founded the Ayyubid dynasty, became the first Ayyubid Sultan of Egypt and then of Syria. And in 1187, he defeated the Crusader army on the Horns of Hattin. This is just to the west of the Sea of Galilee, a distinctive site today. Two little hills that look like a pair of horns. He was a skilled general. He lured the Crusader armies, or he got the Crusader armies surrounded on the open fields of the Horns of Hattin in the blazing hot sunshine, wearing their full armor. That pretty much completely debilitated them, and he won a convincing victory over them. Disastrous day for the Crusaders. He went on and besieged Jerusalem and captured it. And Jerusalem at that point was defended by Balian of Ibleen, who is portrayed in the movie Kingdoms of Heaven. Lots of things wrong with the movie, but the basic characters and the core of it are based on reality there. And then he went on and he captured almost all of these Crusader sites except for the capital cities. So Tripoli itself survived, Antioch itself survived, and Edessa itself survived as just the cities left, and Saladin overran all the rest of it. And he would go on and establish this large empire, so at its greatest extent there in about 1188, having taken over all of Egypt and much of Syria and the Holy Land. The victories of Saladin then led to a call for a third crusade. So this is the state of things before that crusade is called. So we've got just a little bit of Tripoli left, a little bit of Antioch left, the city of Tyre, and not much more. And then Saladin is ruling everything else. The kings of France and England were busy fighting each other, as they were for much of the 12th century. And the two kings put their fighting on hold and agreed to join forces to lead armies off onto the Third Crusade. And then, as soon as this was happening, 1189, Henry II of England died and was succeeded by Richard I Lionheart, who everybody knows of in connection with the Crusades. And they were joined by the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, Barbarossa meaning Redbeard, and he led a large German army. And again, lots of Jews were killed in England and then also in the Rhineland. Having done that killing, they set off to try and recover all this territory that Saladin captured. They were unable to take Jerusalem, but they did manage to take Acre in 1191, so this town here, and that then became the capital of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. So this is how things were after that crusade was over. The Kingdom of Jerusalem is this narrow strip of land stretching from Jaffa up to Beirut, with Acre as its capital. They still called it the Kingdom of Jerusalem and would therefore still have hopes of one day taking Jerusalem and making that the kingdom. Tripoli is once again a little crusader state. Antioch, there's not much left of it. And then they took Cyprus. Cyprus had been part of the Byzantine Empire. So now they've made things even worse with the Byzantine Empire. Not only had they failed after the First Crusade to give Jerusalem to the Byzantines or take any territory and give it back to the Byzantines, now they've begun pinching Byzantine territory and took Cyprus and made it into their Crusader kingdom, so Western European kingdom. Okay, that sets the stage then for the next crusade, the Fourth Crusade. Since they failed to capture Jerusalem, there was still this dream of taking Jerusalem back from Saladin and making it once again the capital of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And so the Pope called for a large army, large group of crusaders, and he had grandiose visions, and he thought they would raise this enormous army. And he then had to figure out, well, how do we get this army to the Holy Land? Previously, they'd gone largely overland, and that didn't work too well. So this time his plan was to build a lot of ships, and he asked the two major naval powers of the time, Genoa and Venice, to build a fleet of ships. Genoa declined. Venice did so, spent a year, put its own merchant trading activities on hold, built an enormous fleet of ships at considerable cost. And then when they were all ready, the crusaders showed up to get on board. But there were only about a third as many crusaders as was anticipated, so the Venetians had built way too many ships. But they demanded full payment, not unnaturally, and the crusaders were unable to pay. They managed to come up with about a third, 40% of the total cost. Then the Venetians insisted that they pay and almost took every last cent from their pocket, so that left the crusaders impoverished. And still the Venetians were demanding payment before they would allow them to board the ships. Meanwhile, the Pope had warned the crusaders not to go and attack any of the other Christians that were in the Middle East. One of the leaders of the Crusades went up to the palace of the Holy Roman Emperor up in Germany, and it so happened that there was the son of the Byzantine Emperor who had recently been deposed. And he promised this visiting crusader leader, if you depose the new Byzantine emperor and put my father back in power, we will pay you all the remaining cost for these Venetian ships, and we'll also give you a whole bunch more things. So he promised the moon. the Crusaders eventually set off. The Venetians were eager to get their full money. The Crusaders sailed down the Adriatic Sea, and they attacked one of the cities along the Dalmatian coast. It was a city that had rebelled against Venetian rule, and the Pope had forbidden them to do this as well, but they ignored that. They sacked the city and took all those riches to help pay off this Venetian debt, but still it was a huge amount of outstanding debt. And then they went to Constantinople, and instead of giving the Byzantines help, they captured the city of Constantinople, deposed the emperor, reinstated the original emperor, the previous emperor, and then his son, who had promised all this money, set about trying to collect that money. And he found it a lot more difficult than he had promised. So he took all the icons out of the churches and he melted them all down for their silver and their gold and handed that over to the Western Crusaders to pay off the Venetians. That sparked riots. Some Catholic Crusaders were attacked. They responded by setting the city on fire, and it turned into a really ugly mess. And then in 1204, the Crusaders came back. Well, the reinstated emperor got deposed again, and then the Crusaders came back, and in 1204, they sacked the city, and they looted it for 3 days, and they set up a Latin kingdom. So a Latin Catholic kingdom, which is this purple here. So ruling in Constantinople and then all either side of the Sea of Marmara and down into Thessalonica and what is today Greece. The Byzantines were forced out and they had this little sort of rump of a kingdom here, the Empire of Nicaea, scarcely big enough to really call it an empire, and then this little bit of Trebizond up here on the south shore of the Black Sea. And that lasted from 1204 to 1261. And that was the end of any remaining goodwill there was between the Byzantines and the Latin Catholics. So up until this point, there might have been a possibility of repairing the Great Schism that happened in 1054. But with the sack of Constantinople in 1204 and the establishment of this Latin kingdom, there was no hope of that. This is something that Pope John Paul II twice apologized for. It's sort of been a black stain on Catholic Orthodox relations. And in 2004, which was the 800th anniversary of the sack of Constantinople, the Ecumenical Patriarch formally accepted that apology. So finally, that damage, has been apologized for, and the apology accepted. And that was a very important step if ever there's to be any further reconciliation between East and West, between the Byzantine Church or the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church. It's really a terrible stain on that. The sad thing about this was the Byzantine Empire never recovered from this. In 1261, the Byzantines were able to retake Constantinople, but they never recovered the strength that they had before, and it was then really just a matter of time, and it took 200 years before they lost and were driven out, and they were defeated by the Muslim empires. So what the Catholics did in 1204 sadly hastened the ultimate demise of Christianity, or of Christian rule from Anatolia and thereabouts. Okay, so after the Fourth Crusade, that then is the arrangement of the world out here. You've got the Latin Empire in Constantinople and down in Thessalonica. You've got what was left of the Byzantine Empire in Nicaea, the Empire Nicaea. Here's the Sultanate of Rum, the Seljuks have that. And then down here, the Armenians still in Cilicia, as they had been for a couple of hundred years. The Fourth Crusade was the last major crusade, but the Crusades carried on for another three or five, depending on how you number them, attempts to regain territory there. The Fifth Crusade, launched in 1213 to 1221, attempted to retake Jerusalem. It failed, and pretty much all of these remaining crusades are abject failures. The Sixth Crusade managed to take Jerusalem and reestablish the Kingdom of Jerusalem for another 15 years, with Jerusalem as its capital. And then the Khwarezmians, people retook Jerusalem. That then, of course, led to another crusade, the Seventh Crusade, led by Louis IX of France. And what they decided to do from now on was to try and approach Jerusalem from Egypt. So try and invade Egypt first and then come up through the Sinai. Unfortunately, they then got their target changed. And instead of trying to attack Egypt, they ended up besieging Tunis, which is a long way from Jerusalem. That ended in disaster. Many of the crusaders... the Seventh Crusade, that's the Eighth Crusade. Seventh Crusade, they did attack Louis IX of France, led that one. They did attack Egypt, which at that time was ruled by the Mamluks. They managed to gain a toehold on the Nile Delta, but they had forgotten or didn't realize that every year the Nile floods, and that wiped out much of their army, and the king got captured, got seriously ill, and was ransomed. So the Egyptian rulers demanded a very high price for him, which was ultimately paid, and he did get free and go back to France, sort of with his tail between his legs. But then he led the next crusade, the Eighth Crusade, which got diverted from attacking Egypt to then besiege Tunis, and in that he died along with many of the other crusaders. And then Edward the Prince, the Black Prince of England, showed up in Tunis, and he was too late to be of any help. So he then went off and went to Acre. So again, this city here, that by this point was about all that was left of the crusaders' hold on the Eastern Mediterranean. Before too long, he then called off what he was doing and went back to England. He had more pressing issues to deal with there, such as subjugating the Welsh. And he then got crowned Edward I of England and never returned. And that really was the end of the Crusades. They sort of petered out. But these last five Crusades, numbers 5 through 9, it was very difficult to rally people to go and join in them. Bruce?
Didn't Urban II basically offer forgiveness or other sins to join the crusade?
Yes. Way back with the original, the First Crusade, and this was part of this giving it this religious veneer, was forgiveness of sins if you go off and fight in the Crusades. Yeah. Like indulgences. And then finally, in 1291, Acre was captured and destroyed, and that was the end of the Crusader states that had been there for almost 200 years, since 1099. The end of this great experiment to try and reestablish Christian rule in that region. Acre then was abandoned for 200 years and then subsequently rebuilt atop the Crusader ruins, which are all now 20 feet below ground level and have been, a lot of that's been excavated and can be explored today. So, not a particularly glorious period of history, of the history of relations between different powers. And again, a matter of considerable controversy within the academic community as to the motives for this. Were the Crusades justified? A tendency to portray the Crusaders as being the aggressors and the brutal people, forgetting that the Muslim rulers were also plenty brutal throughout this time as well. As the Crusades were drawing to a close, another menacing power appeared on the horizon. and that was the Mongol tribes. Sorry, I don't have much here in the notes for that. But the Mongols, so this was beginning with Kublai Khan and Genghis Khan sweeping out of the Central Asian desert, a bit further east than where the Turkic peoples had come from. And they swept westwards and established a series of empires in Central Asia, down into what's today Iran and Mesopotamia and into Syria. You've got groups like the Golden Horde that established themselves between the Caspian and the Aral Sea. There was an empire established called the Ilkhanate, headed by the Hughaylu family, that initially favored Christians and then converted to Islam and subjected the Jews and the Christians to the dhimmi status that we talked about last week, having to pay a poll tax and that. And then the most feared of the Mongol peoples that came was Timur, or Tamerlane, who swept out of the Central Asia and killed an awful lot of Christians, but he killed an awful lot of everybody else as well. I read one estimate that sort of as a direct result of his invasion, 17 million people were killed, which was 5% of the world population. And it's at that point, at least this is according to Philip Jenkins in his book, The Lost History of Christianity, where he looks at this 1,000-year period of the history of the church in the Middle East. He traces the decline of the church to the invasions of Tamerlane. So you'll find his name spelled a couple of ways, Timur or Tamerlane. So this is the early 14th century. The Christians, both the Christians and the Jews, had lived within the Muslim empires under dhimmi status, under dhimmitude. So they were second-class citizens, but they were protected citizens. They were people of the book. They were allowed to practice their religion, but they had to pay a poll tax. And they were second-class status to the Muslims. They had various other restrictions. Jewish or Christian women, if they married a Muslim man, they automatically became Muslim. Muslim women could not marry Christian men or Jewish men. So Jewish men could only marry within their faith community. But the Christians and the Jews survived. At times, under good rulers, they were able to flourish, and even under bad rulers, they were at least able to survive, albeit as secondary class citizens. Timur, or Tamerlane, swept through and killed indiscriminately. He killed Muslims, he killed Jews, he killed Christians. And it was with his invasions then in the 14th century that Philip Jenkins says you get this precipitous decline in the health of the churches of the East. And it was a devastating blow to them that took a long time to recover from. So in his article that was the cover story in Christianity Today for this month, which, sorry, I still haven't put up online, he then asks, are the Christians disappearing from the Middle East? And what causes a Christian community to be wiped out? And he says, well, it's not discrimination. They were discriminated against under these various Muslim caliphates, but they survived. And what causes them to be wiped out is when you get systematic attempts by a ruling power to actually obliterate them. She says is what Timur was doing, and then is what he worries that now ISIS or Islamic State is doing. He's seriously wondering, as many others are there going to be any Christians left in the Middle East within the next 5-10 years? Okay, that's the Crusades. Enough about that. Go to Jerusalem today, you'll see plenty of Crusader history. Same in Akko. Jerusalem, after going back and forth between Crusader rule and Muslim rule, then return to unbroken Muslim rule that lasted up until the 20th century. Okay, any questions about the Crusades or any of that? Yes, Johan.
One thing I was impressed with was not the minor,
these fortresses were massive. Yeah. So the citadel in Jerusalem It's a fairly massive fortress. The biggest, the most impressive one that's still intact is Karak in Jordan along the King's Highway, which is largely intact. Up in northern Israel, there are the ruins of several Crusader castles, and yeah, they're large, they're huge.
Like Belvoir, like massive.
Yeah, there's Belvoir, or Beaver, there's Nimrod's castle, and a couple of others there, and then a number up in Syria and Lebanon.
These guys from Europe building these armies, how did they initially do that? Did they just all hire mercenaries? They have a pile of money, or...
Well, the call went out, and so the most important thing was to try and get some knights. So each family, each noble family in Western Europe, inheritance tended to be based on primogeniture, so the eldest son inherited everything, and then you had the second and third sons who weren't going to inherit anything, and, you know, what are they going to do? Well, one of the things they can go and do is go and become a knight and go off into battle. It's a romantic thing to do. They don't need to stay back and inherit the estate or help run the estate that they're going to inherit. So that's who many of these knights were. And then they would often be able to recruit common people from their villages where they were, from their estates where they were, that would then join the Crusades with them.
When the Crusaders got to the Holy Land or wherever, who did they use to build all these citadels and castles and everything? Did they just subjugate the indigenous folks?
Yeah, I would imagine so. They would subjugate the people, force them to build their castles. Yeah.
From what I understand, when Muslim, even Turkey, they occupied the Middle East and ruled the Christian. They did not have the systematic massacre as did by Crusade or Hummel.
Right.
They conquered a city and occupied and ruled them. That massacre done by Crusade frustrated the Muslim ruler and they produced the race of the debate.
Yes, that's certainly true for the Ottomans and for many others. And they, well, because the Muslims, when they came through, had this policy that the Jews and the Christians, as people of the book, are respected and you don't massacre them and you don't force them to convert. Yeah. You assume rule of their territory, but you allow them to continue to live and practice their religion. And after the break, we'll look and see how did the Ottoman Empire do that. Because the Ottoman Empire, for its first several centuries, the Muslims in the Ottoman Empire were a minority, and Jews and Christians were a majority of the empire. Yeah. And the Crusaders tended to, well, they massacred people, and unfortunately, they started that massacring in Europe, by massacring the Jews. And then when they got to the Middle East, they massacred anybody who looked foreign, anybody who looked Muslim, which meant anybody who looked Arab, which meant Muslims, Jews, Christians, because they all looked foreign.
In Jerusalem, where they occupied, they have several days, relentless massacre.
Yeah, they did that in Jerusalem, all this looting, and then they did that in Constantinople in 1204, and looted that for 3 days, yeah.
Well, why did the Children's Crusade fit into?
So along the way, there was a Children's Crusade, and I can't remember which crusade that was, but yes, that's a particularly shocking time, because the children they've got no ability to go and fight, yeah, and a lot of them lost their lives.
Mm-hmm. You mean the Saladin, right? Who recaptured Jerusalem? He's very peaceful and very sort of very kind. Present the Christian or the Crusade, peaceful.
Yeah, he allowed them to leave. Yeah. Okay, well, let's take a break, and then after that, we'll look at the Ottoman Empire, how that arose, in extent, and then what it did with its Christians and Jews within the empire. Okay, let's get going again. Okay, so I've talked about this Seljuk Sultanate of Rum and the Seljuk Turks. And in the late 13th century, that started disintegrating. It had run a couple hundred years. And it fell apart into a whole group of little statelets run by various Turkish groups. And one of them was established by a guy called Osman, whose father had come from the city of Merv. Now, Merv is sort of way up here in, I think it's Turkmenistan. Early 14th century, it was actually, it's claimed that it was the largest city in the world. Many of you have probably never heard of it. It's a ruin, I think a UNESCO World Heritage site. But was a very important city on the Silk Road to China. And he settled here, and his son Osman set up this little statelet, one of this collection of states called the Ghazi Emirates. He was called Osman, and he established a dynasty called the Osmanli, or what the Turks today call the Osmanli dynasty, or we call the Ottoman dynasty, that would grow. He captured the city of Bursa, made that his capital. Then the empire grew from there and steadily acquired more and more territory. Of note here is in 1389, the Battle of Kosovo, where they defeated the Serbs. So that's up in here. And eventually acquired all of the Balkan Peninsula. But it's that Battle of Kosovo, 1389. The memory of that got rekindled in the civil war there in Yugoslavia. And this hostility between the Muslims and the Serbian Orthodox. And those memories from 700 years ago came back to produce another round of killing and hostility between those religious communities. In 1453, Mehmed II, Cis ruler here, captured Constantinople. Now, Constantinople was very heavily fortified. Constantine had built the first fortifications. Theodosius had built a second set of walls. It was considered impregnable, held off lots and lots of attacks until it was seized by friends, right? The Crusaders, who came as fellow Christians and sacked the city from inside, as it were. Then for 200 years, Constantinople managed to deter repeated Muslim attempts to capture the city. One is because they had such strong walls, and also they had a chain that they strung across the Golden Horn. And they had what's called Greek fire, which is a sort of a napalm or something, some liquid that had been invented that they were able to hurl buckets of this stuff at ships, and it would set the sea on fire, and water wouldn't extinguish it. In fact, water, if anything, kindled it to burn fast. So this stuff would float on the water and just blaze and burn up all the ships. And they managed to hold off repeated attempts to try and capture the city. By 1453, they couldn't withstand any longer, and Mehmed II, Mehmed the Conqueror, captured the city. And that ended, well, almost ended the Byzantine Empire. It carried on for just a little bit longer, a little enclave up here, Trebizond, for another few decades. But that was the end of Constantinople as a Christian city, as a Greek city, or a Roman city, depending on how you view things, after over 1,100 years, over 11 centuries of it being the center of the Byzantine Empire. So it was very much the end of an era. And the last emperor was Constantine the 11th. He was killed then. And Mehmed claimed the caliphate. We've seen there's been the succession of caliphates. There was the Rashidun caliphate, the first four successors. There's the Umayyad caliphate, the Abbasid caliphate. For a short while, there was the Fatimid caliphate. Then there was the caliphate that Saladin established. And then now the Ottomans, Mehmed II, took that, proclaimed himself to be the caliph, therefore to be the ruler of the world's Muslims, or at least of all the Sunni Muslims, which would be 85 to 90% of the world's Muslims, and to rule on their behalf, and they would all recognize that rule. And that caliphate will last until 1924, when Ataturk abolished it. Mehmed II continued to expand the empire. He conquered Baghdad as well. Oh, sorry, not under Mehmed. First of all, Selim extended the territory a good bit further, and then Suleiman the Magnificent captured Baghdad. He besieged Vienna in 1529. That siege was broken, and then 150 years later, the Ottomans will make another attempt to besiege Vienna. But that's as how far up into Europe the Ottoman Empire extended. And it had taken over the entire Balkan Peninsula. With their extension down to Baghdad, took over all of Mesopotamia. Suleiman the Magnificent is the one who built the current walls of the old city of Jerusalem, which are almost completely intact, and was a great ruler. And the Ottoman Empire reached almost its greatest extent under him. Its greatest extent is sort of bracketed by these two sieges of Vienna, 150 years apart. The second siege was sort of a last gasp, and after that, the Ottoman Empire began to decline. Mid-19th century, it attempted to turn western. The sultans abandoned the Topkapi Palace, their palace where they were, and built themselves a new palace, the Dolmabahçe Palace. Those who've been to Istanbul might have seen that. And tried to westernize. Around the 1890s, there was this movement called the Young Turks that attempted to bring more Western-leaning modernism to the empire. But throughout the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire really began to break apart. The British took Cyprus. The British took Egypt. Well, Egypt sort of became almost semi-independent under British oversight. Early 20th century, the Italians captured Libya. In the 1830s, Greece got independence. The Italians took these little islands here and Rhodes. And by the outbreak of the First World War, Turkey was the sick man of Europe. It joined sides with the Germans in the First World War, came out on the losing side, and then its empire got carved up in the years following the First World War. And much of the current configuration of the Middle East is the result of that carving up that was done at the end of the First World War, which we will move on and look at. The Sultanate was abolished in 1922, and in 1923, the Turkish Republic was proclaimed by Ataturk as a secular republic. And a lot of the outward symbols of Muslim rule and identity were suppressed. Turkey is now ruled, well, effectively ruled, by someone who is undoing as many of Ataturk's policies as he can. Erdogan, who served two terms as prime minister, then got termed out, and won election as president, which was a ceremonial role, but he is now making it into a role with real power. So he's doing in Turkey exactly what Putin did in Russia. And he's from an Islamic party and suppressing a number of freedoms in Turkey. A few days ago, well, he's building a palace at enormous expense, and a few days ago claimed that the Muslims discovered North America. And do you see that? Yes. Yeah. Claims that Columbus wrote about a mosque on top of a hill in Cuba. He's headed in some unfortunate directions. But what I want to move on is, as the Ottoman Empire expanded and became this sizable empire that stretched across North Africa through much of the Middle East, they had control of Mecca and Medina, the Islamic holy sites, all of the Balkans and Anatolia, how did they treat their religious minorities? And for a long time, it was a minority Muslim rule. The Muslims were a minority within their vast empire. As they expanded so much into Europe, they took over a lot of areas, a large, a sizable Jewish population and a very sizable Christian population. And they managed these religious populations under a system called the millet. And milla is the Arabic word for nation. So this is sort of like nation. And the forerunners of this go back to the Sassanid Empire of Persia. And the Sassanids were Zoroastrian, but they had within their empire a large number of Christians, the Church of the East, what would later become the Nestorian Church. And initially, the Sassanids viewed these Christians with suspicion. They viewed them as being agents of the West, of the Roman and Byzantine empires, until they realized that they had been excommunicated as a result of the Fourth Ecumenical Council in 451. And at that point, they then viewed them as being, well, any enemy of the Byzantine Empire is a friend of ours. And they protected them, gave them a protected status. And the Catholicos of the East, ruling out of Ctesiphon near Babylon, later elevated to a patriarch, was the leader of all the Christians in the Sassanid Empire. And he reported directly to the Persian ruler. He was free to administer the affairs of the Christian population, the sizable Church of the East within the Sassanid Empire. The Ottoman Turks then employed that same system, and they allowed the various faith communities within their empire to be self-governing for most of their internal affairs, to collect taxes on behalf of their peoples, and to administer their people according to their particular set of laws. So for the Muslims, that would be Sharia law. For the Christians, that would be various sets of canon law. And then for the Jews, that would be according to their halakhic laws, their Talmudic laws of the Jewish community. In 1453, having captured Constantinople, they declared a milla for the Byzantine Christians. And they called that the Rum milla, the Roman milla. Right? So again, these Byzantine Christians they spoke Greek, would have thought of themselves in a sense as Greek, but also in a sense as being Roman, because they were still what was left of the Roman Empire. So the Rum milla was all the Byzantine Greeks, and they were under the authority of the Ecumenical Patriarch in Constantinople, who administered their affairs, and they lived, they practiced their Christianity, they had all their churches, they had the church hierarchy, and all the internal affairs of that community, of that milla, were administered by the patriarch. Then there was a second Christian milla, the Armenian Christians had their own separate milla, and included within that originally were all the other churches of the East. Now the Armenian Christians are a monophysite group, so they've been excommunicated by the Fourth Ecumenical Council, and then there were these various other monophysite groups and excommunicated groups that had been excommunicated by the Byzantines, that all got the Ottomans initially considered them all within under the Armenian milla. But they then petitioned to have their own separate milla and were granted that. So the Syriac Orthodox Christians, who were monophysite, what would then also get called the Jacobite Christians. So there was a milla for the Jacobite Christians under their leader. There was a milla for the Church of the East, what would be considered the Nestorian Christians. There was a milla for the Coptic Christians, who were monophysites down in Egypt. All self-governing under their particular rules. The Chaldean Catholics, Christians of the Church of the East, who then had still followed the Byzantine, or still followed the Eastern Rite, the Syriac Rites, but then were loyal to the Catholic Church. The Syriac Catholics, likewise, and then we've mentioned the Church of the East. So they all became their separate millahs. And then the Jewish population were their own millah with a chief rabbi and so on. The leaders of each of these millets reported directly to the Sultan or to his sublime port, right? The council of the Sultan in Constantinople, initially called the Divan. Divan is a big couch on which the Sultan would sit. And then later on called the Sublime Port, the Sublime Door. It was where the ambassadors reported and where these leaders of the religious communities reported. In the 19th century, later 19th century, various Western powers started bullying the Ottoman Empire, would be one way of putting it, to make capitulations. Now, the very use of that term, a capitulation, implies that you're bullying the person. And getting them to capitulate on allowing these Western powers to then be the protectors of particular groups within the Ottoman Empire. So, for example, the Russians wanted the Ottomans to capitulate and allow the Russians to be the protectors of the Orthodox Christians within Palestine, for example. The Western powers, certain of them, wanted them to capitulate and allow them to be the protectors of the Catholics and so on. And this millet system began to break down a bit. By the time the First World War broke out, there were 17 different millets within the Ottoman Empire. So 17 of these really autonomous religious communities. The millah that you were in, so millah, again, is the Arabic word for nation, but it's not your ethnicity that mattered, it was your religion. And that's what formed a people. In a sense, within the Ottoman Empire, there were two major ethnicities. There were the Turkish people and the Arabic people. But within the Arabic people, you had Christians of these multiple different flavors, and you had Jews, and then you had the Muslims who could be Sunni or they could be Shia. And each of the different Arab Christian communities could be part of a different millah. And they hung together as a community, and that was their identity. And that system worked very well. There was discrimination inherent in the system because all these other different millets were subservient, had less status than the Muslim community. So in any dispute, if there was a dispute involving somebody from the Muslim people, Muslim community, and any of these other communities, it was the Muslim community and the rules of the Muslim community that held precedence. But these different religious communities were able to flourish. And it ensured a large measure of religious harmony within the Ottoman world. It wasn't democracy. It wasn't everybody of equal status. There were two different statuses, you know, going back to this whole idea of dhimmi. But the peoples of the book, the Christians and the Jews, were able to be self-governing. The Ottoman Sultanate was abolished in 1922. It limped along for a few years after the First World War, and then was abolished. And then the Ottoman Caliphate was abolished finally by Ataturk in 1924. He'd been looking to abolish it for a couple of years, and finally in 1924 he got a good excuse to do that. But this millet system survives in various ways in a lot of the countries of the Middle East. And if you don't understand how this millet system works, it can be a little confusing. So one of the places it survives is in Israel. So I'll give you a few examples of places where it survives. So in Israel, you are not simply an Israeli citizen. You are part of a religious community. And that's what is then marked on your identity. So you are Jewish, or you are Christian, and that can be Catholic, or Protestant, or Orthodox, or various flavors of Christian, or you're Muslim. There isn't a plain Israeli citizenship. And yet, most of the Jews in Israel are secular, and some of the more adamant secular ones say, we don't want to be identified, have any religious identification. We just want to be Israeli citizens. And that is impossible. Israeli law doesn't provide for that. They're still working within this, that your primary, your identification is with a religious community, even though you may be totally non-observant. Here, you have the concept that you're a U.S. citizen, and then your faith, your religious identity, is a private matter between you. This then means that if that is your identity, it then is difficult to change your identity, right? And so this arises for Jews who become Christians or Jews who have become believers and then try to immigrate into Israel. They can't do that. You can be totally secular and get automatic, if you're Jewish, automatic right of return into Israel, but not if you're... assume the battery just failed. Well, it's only 10 minutes ago. I'll see if I can speak loud enough with a throat lozenge in my mouth. So you can't readily change your community that you're part of. So it means that Israel, which in many ways functions as a Western democracy, still is functioning for purposes of identity according to the system of the Ottoman Empire. Then when it comes to being part of the Jewish community, the only recognized Jewish milah, as it were, is Orthodox Judaism. You may know there are three branches of in Western Europe and the U.S., there are three branches, main branches of Judaism, Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. Conservative and Reform Judaism are not recognized in Israel. So that means that they can't perform marriages, or marriages aren't recognized because they're not part of this recognized legal system. And the only recognized marriage within a Jewish community is a marriage conducted by the Orthodox, under Orthodox law. So there's a lot of people in Israel who go off to Cyprus to get married, because they can't get married within Israel. So that's one area. Talking of Cyprus, that's another area in which this milah system applied up until 1974. I mentioned this a few weeks ago, but those of you who can remember the events of 1974, there was a military coup in Greece. That caused trouble in Cyprus. Turkey felt threatened, and that the Turkish population of Cyprus was under threat from this Greek saber-rattling, and so they invaded and took over the northern third of the island and proclaimed the Democratic Republic of North Cyprus, that no other country recognizes. But the leader of the Cyprus community at that point was Archbishop Makarios, who was the religious leader of the Christians on Cyprus, or certainly the majority Christians who were Greek Orthodox in the Greek Orthodox Church of Cyprus. But then was also, because the British had left in place this milah system, he was then still functioning as the political leader of them as well. He was the leader, as it were, of this nation. Another area that this applies is in, say, in Iraq. So in Iraq, you had the Sunnis operating as a community, the Shias operating as a community, the Kurds operating as a community. And the U.S. invaded in 2003. With this wonderful idea, well, let's liberate the Iraqi people and institute democracy. So they call for democratic elections, and let's say what, there's 20 million, I don't know exactly, I'll just pull some numbers, 20 million Sunni Christians and 5 million, sorry, no, it's the other way around. The Sunnis are the minority. It's 20% Sunnis and... well, it wouldn't be 80% Shiites, because there was this large 2.5 million Christians as well. But how many independent votes are you going to get if you have, quote-unquote, democratic elections there? You're only going to get 3 independent votes, because the Sunnis are all a community. They're a millah. So they're just going to vote the way the leadership tells them to vote. And the Shias are a community, they're a millah, they're just going to vote that way. And you've got one vote just multiplied by a few million people. So you can't get democracy in a system like that. It would require a fracturing of that whole system to actually get people to vote independently, which is what democracy requires. I assume there was some profound lack of understanding as to how these communities work. But it did allow these various communities to live in relative peace with one another, and then that got completely torn apart and led to all the sectarian violence that we currently have. But the Shias, the Sunnis, and the Christians had all lived intermingled with each other for centuries under the Ottoman Empire, and even under Saddam Hussein, each somewhat self-governing, and the 2.5 million Christians of Iraq were protected, had their own leadership, and that's all been completely torn apart. And I don't know how you put the pieces back together again. Al-Maliki has certainly not done that. He's, as a Shiite, he's discriminated against the Sunni community. Another area that this carries on is in, let's say, the Palestinian territories. So in the days of the Ottoman Empire, Anatolia was primarily Turkish, and the area on the south of that, Mesopotamia, rest of the Middle East, was Arab, and those were the two primary parts of the Ottoman Empire. Within the Arab world, you had Arab Christians, Arab Muslims, and Arab Jews. Yes, there really were Arab Jews, which today seems an oxymoron, but they were there. And it was perfectly okay to be an Arab Jew, perfectly okay to be an Arab Christian, and your primary identity was that you were a Christian, you were a Jew, you were a Muslim, operating within the millah. You all spoke Arabic, you all looked like each other, and you all lived next door to each other. With the growth of Arab nationalism, really beginning with Nasser, Jamal Nasser, back in the 1950s, there was this move to identify, to try and promote a trans-Arab nationalism that increasingly led to this equation of being Arab equals being Muslim. And that caused problems for, well, there were already problems arising for the Arab Jews, and that has caused increasing problems for the Arab Christians, because this possibility of being a people group that is Arab Christian is becoming increasingly difficult to hold to with this attempt to identify, to equate religion with ethnicity. And so it puts the Arab Christians in a very, very difficult position in many of these countries. The whole concept of what is a nation is problematic throughout these worlds. And the idea of being of a nation is very different from the state lines that are drawn on the map. So one of the next things we'll move on and look at is why are the lines drawn on the map the ways that they are? But basically, the British and the French drew lines on maps and said, okay, now you are the country of Iraq. There's never been a country of Iraq. How do you create a national identity? And all of this is unraveling. There is no cohesive sense of what it means to be an Iraqi. And now the Islamic State, one of its first acts that it did was to bulldoze the line separating Iraq from Syria, saying, this is an irrelevant concept. And I don't know if that's what we're increasingly going to see, the unraveling of these straight lines that were drawn on maps by people sitting in Paris and London back at the end of the First World War. So that's this whole business of the millah and its leftover effects today, and this is trying to figure out what is people's identity. Their primary identity has never been a particular country. It's this, for so long they were these religious communities. Then the second thing is about the caliph. Mehmed II, after he conquered Constantinople, proclaimed himself to be the caliph, the leader of the Muslim world, the Sunni Muslim world. And that caliphate then survived all the way down to 1924. The last caliph was then exiled. And there was no caliph up until early this year, when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi proclaimed himself to be the caliph, the caliph, the successor, and claimed that he had lineage going back to Muhammad, and that therefore he was qualified to be a caliph. The Ottoman caliphs had no lineage going back to Muhammad, but for a Sunni caliph, that doesn't really matter. Al-Baghdadi, Islamic State, they're a hardline Sunni group, but as part of his justifying his claim to be the caliph was this descent from Muhammad. That's why then he called upon all Muslims everywhere to acknowledge that claim and to recognize him as their leader, no matter what country they're in. And you get these various groups then have done that. But I would imagine the great majority of Muslims would view his claim to be the caliph as being preposterous, and that's not what they want. They wouldn't view him as being qualified. He's the wrong sort of person to be that. That's just to explain what the significance of that claim is that he made, claiming that he is the caliph. So he follows in the succession of the Rashidun, the Umayyad, the Abbasid, and so on, and the Ottoman caliphs. Okay, so the point of the millet system is that's really important understanding how the Middle East has functioned from a religious point of view, and then that affects the various Christian groups, because there are these half dozen, six or eight different Christian groups who all were allowed to flourish as independent Christian groups, each with their leadership. So the Church of the East, that's the Nestorians, the Chaldeans, the Assyrians, the Syrian Orthodox, who are the Jacobites, the Coptic Christians, the Greek Orthodox, the Armenians, all as their separate communities, and all of them are now under threat. Okay, any questions about that, either the Ottoman Empire or the millet, this millet system? Okay, next week we won't meet. It's Thanksgiving week. I will be gone at a conference. And in 2 weeks' time, we should have here somebody that Sue and I have gotten to know over the last 6 months, who has spent several decades working in the Middle East with Christians. And so I've asked him to come and speak and talk about his decades of working with Christians. And then what I want to move on then after that is look more closely at what happened in the First World War and the aftermath of the First World War that led to the current configuration of the Middle East and where the Christians fit into that, why we have what we have today. Well, let's pray. God, our Father, it is grievous to look at this history and to see the great amount of violence that has been done in the name of religion, in the name of God, including the great amount of violence that's been done by those who claim to be your people, who've gone into battle under the sign of the cross as the Crusaders, the great slaughter that occurred. We thank you for the ruler that you have appointed over your church, even the Lord Jesus Christ, that he is the Prince of Peace, whose weapon is his word, not the sword, who did not react with violence, but submitted to those who proceeded to put him on trial and to kill him. And thank you for the power of your gospel that is ultimately more powerful than the sword and is able to transform people and change them. Father, I pray for your people in the Middle East who, of all these different religious groups, who are suffering at the point of the sword, all the explosives and the guns and the bombs and all that goes off, that you would sustain them and give them courage to stand firm, to not resort with violence, but to follow in the footsteps of the Lord Jesus Christ and to rely upon him. Keep them in your love and care, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.